Pass to order about 3:05, February 12th. Committee members present are Representative Jewell, Cisna, Wilson, Coring, Coghill, and myself, Dyson. Representative Stevens is presenting a bill in Military and Veterans Affairs and will be joining us shortly. It is House Bill 309 has been pulled off the agenda for today, and I don't know when it'll be back up, but probably soon. We will hear House Bill 252, Standards of Care and Child in Need of Aid Services, and then House Bill 367, Medical Assistant Program Coverage. As it is my intention on House Bill 252, I believe there's a committee substitute and some amendments, and we will move those, and then we will take testimony both from the sponsor and the department, and then it is my intention to hold it over on voting until Thursday. And my reasoning is that whenever we significantly alter a bill and all the committee hasn't had a chance to look at it, I like to, when we can, give everybody a chance to think about it and digest it, and for its enemies to reload and be ready to fire again, and its supporters to be able to reiterate their support. And I understand that there's a significant amount of testimony, some of which we've heard on email, and it'll be coming in both in the LIOs and offline on House Bill 367, and we will hear as much of that as we can. If we don't get through with it, then we will continue the next time we meet. Is that agreeable, committee? All right. So first up today, we have House Bill 252, Standard of Care for China or Children in Need of Aid. Mr. Coghill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would ask that you adopt the CS for House Bill 252, Draft J, 22-LS0454/J, as our working document.
Everybody have that one? Is there objection to the committee substitute being our working document on this bill? Seeing none, the committee substitute is adopted. That's CS for House Bill 252, yes. All right, that's the working document then before us. Please continue.
Just to give you some explanation, heard some very compelling testimony in one of the Finance Subcommittee hearings on the need and for some of the workers. And I think the standard and duty of care that I created in the latter part of this probably would put a greater pressure on it, although I'm not against that pressure. But I just, you know, you always get to that balance. You figure where can you raise the standard and not meet the need? And so I think by repealing in statute that there is not a standard created, I think that puts enough upward pressure. I'm satisfied with that. I still think that we should go forward with including the parents in the process, and I'm prepared to take any amendments to the bill on that account. And I think that probably a little better working bill, probably a little less teeth, but maybe some more positive movement, Mr. Chairman.
Let the record reflect that our distinguished member from Fairbanks agrees with the department on something.
I'll need it for later.
Storing up a reservoir of goodwill here. All right.
And just for your information, I did ask my chief of staff, Geneva, to come forward and answer questions as we might in the amendment process, but I don't anticipate that we, you know.
All right. So please tell the committee, Geneva or John, what the committee substitute changes, and over the original bill.
Chairman Dyson, what it changes is the requirement for a Division of Youth and Family Services to adopt regulations setting a standard of duty and a or excuse me, setting a duty and standard of care. The department right now, or the division right now, and they can address this, do have policies and procedures that they follow that are very similar to the standards that we were addressing in this piece of legislation, and basically just takes the pressure off of them to do something right now in the way of regulations. But what it does do is it repeals from the statutes the language that says there is no duty or standard of care.
All right, is there any questions for the maker or for Renita? I guess then I guess I'd like to hear from the department what your views are on the committee substitute.
Mr. Chairman, Teresa Tenori, Director for Division of Family and Youth Services. We appreciate the change in this, that last section. As I said earlier before this committee, that we do have standards. We agree the standards are a good thing. We hold workers to a standard. There's code of ethics that we hold them to. We've taken personnel actions based on those standards, and so I think this is an easier draft to swallow for us. We still have, some comments about the construction that was held over from our first position that we took, we will readjust our fiscal note and bring it back before you for Thursday.
All right, so you have no objection then to the, line 8, recognizing a parent possess inherent rights and all that sort of stuff?
Mr. Chairman, I think Department of Law has some thoughts on this. For us, as we said earlier, we have, basically that construction paragraph has in the past lent itself towards children's best interests. This puts a parent's interests a little bit more than the child's interests. And we do have some objections to that, and felt that in talking with Representative Coghill, there could be a more balanced statement in there that would promote the children's best interests as equally with parents would be a good thing. And I think Department of Law can better explain that.
That you, Doug? Okay, please.
Mr. Chair, I'm Jan Rutherdale from the Attorney General's Office, and I'm testifying only on Section 1. Susan Cox from the Department of Law can speak to Section 2.
Excuse me, for the record, Representative Stevens has joined us.
This statute, 4710.005 under Section 1, is a statutory construction provision, and so it only comes up in situations where the court, let's say there's a statute that's ambiguous, we're not quite sure, not the best worded, and in the context it's not clear, in the facts of the case how to apply it. And so what this says originally without the amendments, it says when you're not sure what the statute says, the court will interpret it keeping in mind in a way that will promote the child's welfare. So basically a best interest of the child interpretation. By rewording it this way, it says you have to also look at the parents' right to educate and bring up their children. But I think in the process, it creates a gridlock for the court. I mean, it's like, well, what do I look at? Do I look at promoting the child's welfare, or do I interpret it to, recognizing the parents' inherent rights? And so I think it doesn't help the court in those type of situations. But I have maybe some other suggestions, which is in 4705065, that's a statute that was enacted in 1998 when the China laws were revised, and those are the legislative findings. And I think the sort of wording that's already in here is you'll find in those legislative findings. For example, parents have the following rights, the responsibility to provide food, clothing, shelter, education, medical care. Section B is the right and responsibility to train, discipline, protect, nurture, provide reasonable discipline, that sort of thing, determine where the child shall live. So all those kind of rights and responsibilities that are set up in the legislative findings, I think, are the kind of what they're saying right here is that parents possess those types of rights and responsibilities in raising their children. And so I think either if that needs to be revised, either it says what is trying to be said right here, or if there needs to be revisions to this, if it's not clear what the legislature intended, then that could be amended there. But to put those revisions in the construction statute creates this kind of gridlock that I don't think helps the court. If there's specific problems, like if there's actual provisions in the statute that is ambiguous or hard to understand, then maybe there should be amendments to those provisions. But that's my testimony with respect to construction.
So if I understand it, you don't really object to what it says. You just don't feel it. Department of Law does not feel that this is the appropriate place in statute for it to show up.
Actually, thank you for clarifying that. As far as the particular wording, I think that by saying that the parents possess inherent individual rights to direct and control the education, I guess I would be concerned that that could somehow be used. I mean, the Constitution creates certain rights. You know, courts may say that there's inherent, you know, like inherent right of privacy, or actually in our Constitution, it's an actual right of privacy, for example. But to sort of create a sort of statutory pronouncement of inherent individual rights to direct and control the education, for example, I'm just wondering if that may complicate things later, like in education bills, saying, well, you know, my child, you know, I have a right to direct how the public funds are spent to educate my child, for example. You know, I mean, I have concerns about that word, but I'd be happy to work in coming up with some other language to get at that meaning. And it may be that in looking through the legislative findings, I mean, that sort of language is already there.
All right, help me out here. What's the difference in the weight of what it means if this is in the, quote, findings, as opposed here to a paragraph that heads up by construction?
I don't think there's... I'm not sure the answer to that, but I know that when I'm making arguments to the court in a brief, you know, in a written document, for example, or oral document, I often point to the legislative findings. Look, Your Honor, you know, this is what the legislature found, so you know you should find this way because this is really important to the legislature. The construction is, in a way, the similar argument, but the point is, I think, in giving guidance to the court, you know, when in doubt, this is the side you should err on, is clear to the court. The court can consider other things, like, well, you know, I'd also like to consider the things that are put in the legislative findings, but I think to put more than just one thing in the construction is going to confuse the court in figuring out which way to lean.
Okay.
And I guess I should say it. I don't think it would come up very often because hopefully the statutes, at least in my practice, there hasn't been many instances, maybe I don't think I've had any instances in the new laws where the statute, the judge says, I don't understand what this means. Could someone, you know, help interpret this for me or something? It's pretty clear what it
we
means.
We did a good job,
you
I
did
remember.
Do, yep.
but what does the term construction mean legally?
How do you construe something? How do you interpret? You know, what does this law mean? What does it say?
Okay. All right. Any questions?
Just one.
Yes.
The statutory site that you gave for the findings again was
4705060. And it's kind of odd because it's stuck in the Administration of Welfare, Social Services, and Institutions. It's not in Chapter 10, which deals with children in need of aid, but it's clear that those legislative findings apply to Chapter 10. I mean, for one thing, they were all part of the same legislative package.
Any other questions for Jan? If you can hang around for a few
sure.
minutes. Susan? By the way, the flowers here were not sent to me by the committee. They're from my wife.
Very nice. Good afternoon.
The committee likes me, but.
Yeah. My name is Susan Cox. I'm an assistant attorney general. I do personal injury defense work for the state. I'm supervisor of the special litigation section here in Juneau. As the chair is aware, the language in section that is to be repealed by Section 2 of the committee substitute was part of the Smart Start package that was enacted by the legislature back in 1998. And at the time that sentence was inserted in the legislation, the idea was that we did not want to see new liabilities created by the Smart Start legislation. This section, duty and standard of care not created, was included in the package to make clear that the legislature was not intending to create new civil liabilities, claims for damages possible against the state or state employees if specific or selective provisions of the Smart Start legislation were not met down to the letter. The section does not immunize the state in any way, shape, or form. As the committee is undoubtedly well aware, the Department of Health and Social Services and its employees can be sued for negligence if children are not properly protected. And the standard would be negligence and the failure to take reasonable care to protect them. But the idea behind 4710960 was to ensure that all of the laudatory goals included in the Smart Start legislation were not used selectively to create a new claim for damages against the department or the department's employees. And I know the chair and I and other people, Susan Wipker and folks from our office, met about this idea at the time, and this was part and parcel of the whole package when it was enacted 4 years ago. The problem for that we foresee, the we being defense attorneys for the state of Alaska who do look after the liability claims made against the state, is by repealing this sentence for whatever reason, the implication is that the legislature intends to mean something. And the question is, what is the meaning? Is the meaning that by taking that language out, the legislature is saying, yes, we do want the state to be held accountable in civil claims for damages for any violation, however significant or insignificant, of the many provisions of 4710, for example. If by example, an effort was made to take action in a child protection case, and the social workers and the Department of Law represents them, attorneys like Ms. Rutherdale put on the best case to the court, and the court determined that not enough had been done to establish a case for termination of parental rights, for example, and they need to make further efforts. does that mean that the legislature would then want to impose now potential liability claims for damages that the parents could bring, because even though the child protection case may continue and who knows, maybe parental rights are ultimately terminated, now there is a claim for, because the courts found that they didn't do quite enough when they prosecuted that case. That's what we're concerned about. Obviously, when the Smart Start legislation passed, there were many goals, and there was also the request for a large fiscal note and the funding for many additional social workers and to reduce caseloads and other things. And I think it was understood at the beginning that not all the deadlines and time frames could possibly be met, at least initially, with the resources available. And we're certainly concerned that that we not create new liabilities by changing the language or taking the language out of this section. If the idea is that there is an objection to this saying that Title 47 doesn't create a standard of care for serving children, and the statement wants to be made that we want the department to be following this, I think that's clear. The department knows they have to follow this. It is that all the provisions of 4710 are law and are the kind of things that the department has policies and procedures to implement and lawyers to help them accomplish that. If that language is objectionable and needs to be removed, we would certainly request that if it is not the legislature's intention to create new liabilities, that we come up with some substitute language that makes that point clear.
Don't go away.
Okay.
Do we increase the possibility of employees being sued if we take this out and it was already there? Does that make it worse than if it had never been there?
I would have to say it certainly raises the possibility, because the language, it has been in there. It's assumed that the legislature means everything it says.
And knew
because
what we were
you've
doing.
Said that, and then when you take it out, and then the question is, well, then what is the meaning? What is the intention? If you're taking that out, is the intention to now authorize new claims? Certainly the argument will be made. Whether a plaintiff's attorney would carry the day on that would certainly be one we'd fight off. But
sure. Representative Sisna?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you're looking at who to sue in a situation like that, what does the court see as the difference between the accountability of the department versus the accountability of the worker themselves?
Representative Sisna, through the chair, the choice of who to sue is completely in the up to the plaintiff. The person who wants to sue can sue strictly the state of Alaska. They can sue the Department of Health and Social Services. They can attempt to sue the commissioner. They can sue the social worker personally. In virtually all cases, the Attorney General's office represents whoever the defendants are, but it pertains to carrying out of their official duties as a state employee. So from my perspective, because I defend such cases, it doesn't make any difference. But it is the plaintiff's choice who they want to go after. In the end, in most cases, if there is a liability situation where we're looking at trying to resolve it by paying a settlement or going to trial and seeing the outcome, the money involved is the state's money. There it would be a very rare occasion, only where a social worker acted completely outside the course and scope of their employment, where they would possibly have personal liability.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Is there a wording that we could change that so that what we're after is not that there's no standard, but that the department will be diligent about following their own policy and procedures and regulation?
Chair, I would be happy to try to work on something between now and Thursday if this bill's being held over to come up with something that hopefully would not create a new liability, but would send the message that I believe you're trying to send, that you know, this is this legislation is a standard you want the department following.
Senator Coghill?
I certainly would be open to that, but I want it clear that I think that there should be the continuing responsibility which does create the liability. I think excusing them is not wise. The whole Child in Need of Aid statute is meant to protect children. We give some judicial and some police powers to people, and we have excused them from this exact language from certain responsibilities. I don't think that's wise. And so I think this is upping the limit. I think that's going to help us to do things better. I was willing to drop the exact language for how they should do it, but I still think we need to have the upward pressure of saying there is responsibility for the actions that we take. As a government, I think the limited scope of government is always wise to keep nice, clear lines at. So I agree that there's a responsibility level that's elevated here. I'm not too sure I'm interested in language that will excuse that. If we can help them understand what their responsibility is better, I'm open.
And not necessarily appear to be authorizing lawsuits.
Right.
Is that your concern of our taking it out?
That's exactly my concern, Chair Dyson. I'm definitely concerned about increasing the likelihood of lawsuits where we don't have them all now. And if I may just clarify something for Representative Coghill, this language that is in the bill now does not immunize social workers in any way, shape, or form. They are still subject to litigation now under the current law, and so is the department if they are negligent in the provision of services to children they are supposed to protect.
Just in that frame, Mr. Chairman, it's also true that you said that by taking this language out, the liability elevates.
Well, the difference here is, if I may, this provision just says that no specific line or sentence in the Smart Start legislation can be taken out and construed to create a claim against the department in and of itself for damages against the social worker or the department. That the legislation that we passed with goals about how quickly certain things would happen in children's cases, that none of that in itself creates a liability. But at the same time, we did not immunize the department and say they could never be sued. And they can and are sued for negligence, you know, when a plaintiff feels that the provision of services to a child was negligently provided. It just means that nothing in the bill itself created a new cause of action. But the possibility of suing for failure to act reasonably and providing services still exists now and would still exist. Taking this out, though, is an invitation to some to say, well, because they've taken that out, that must mean that this provision back here gives me, if it doesn't go the way I don't think they've done it properly, then I can sue for that specific thing, and that gives me a new cause of action, new claim, another theory, an alternative way to get after the state, which right now we don't have that argument.
Representative Coghill?
And I just submit that there have been timing issues that are brought about by this that have created harm, and I think that some of those things need to be addressed. So, you know, I mean, we're saying to other people, you've got to do it by our timeline, but if we don't do it, we can interpret these to our benefit, but you can't interpret them to your benefit. You know, I find that problematic. So I agree that it does do that, but we have given police powers and judicial powers to people who are overseeing, you know, the child in need of aid cases, and I think the tension there is important.
We're getting close to debating the bill here.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Thanks for the latitude.
Any other questions or comments, the committee? Stand by, if you will. The chair will now entertain amendments. Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to make an amendment. And before you have a copy of And I don't know that this, there is a, this would be amendment number two, is that correct?
Negative, amendment number one to the, okay, to the committee substitute.
Okay, it's committee substitute, okay. And the wording on your copy, there's a change here.
Wait a minute, you're talking about the amendment that's on our desk here, and it's
yes.
Lauterbach on 2502, and it's 22-LS0454/F1?
F1, yes.
Right.
And on that one, please delete the first two lines.
Wait a minute. I think we better get the amendment before us before we amend the amendment.
You are so right. I move amendment number one.
All right. Is there objection? Hearing none, we have before us then, as a working document, an amendment number one. Please continue.
Please slash out line number, delete line number one and two. And this starts on line number four.
All right. So the amendment to the amendment is to delete lines one and two. That's line one reads page one, comma, line three, comma, following families. That's deleted. And in line two on page one, insert relating to intensive family preservation service. That's also deleted.
You are right.
Is there objection to the amendment to amendment one?
Actually, it's a little more.
Okay.
Let's go a little bit further here. Line four, which of course will be renumbered, will say, is mended to say page two, comma, following line one, and this is to reflect the new CS.
Page two following line one?
Yes.
All right, so on line four, page one of the amendment, it will read page two, comma, following line one?
Yes.
Is there an objection to that amendment?
Okay.
Seeing none, that's accepted.
And Mr. Chair, to summarize this, and do you wish to have us go into a summary of this, because I'd like to have my aide.
Well, just a minute. Did you all get the dates all straightened out?
We got the dates straightened out.
They are straightened out on the copies that are before us. All right.
Yeah. We got them.
All right. And the amendment that we have adopted has some pen and ink changes on it for here on it, but let the record reflect that those are a part of the official amendment. All right. Tell us.
Did you check this out? Mr. Chair, can we take a...
Yeah, brief at ease.
Thank you.
Record.
Mr.
Representative Sisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this the way this starts is actually after Section 3. So the last sentence in the CS is actually should have been deleted, and it then starts with. That should have been deleted, and this starts with a new Section 3. You see?
All right.
Okay. And
so I think the proper thing to do here is to move an amendment to the CS that deletes the language in Section 3, which starts line 1 of page 2.
Right. And that would be... That'd be amendment one, right?
The amendment or something.
Something.
Right. So the amendment is to delete the on the CS, line one, page two. Delete everything. Yeah, on line one.
Right.
Correct. Is there objection? All right. Seeing none, we have done so. Then do you want? Yeah. Then you're fine?
Then we're fine. We start now with, would this be an amendment two to add the rest of the language here?
I think we've already done that.
Okay, yeah, we have done it. It's sort of, back-ass word is the term?
Get that on the record.
Excuse me, is that on the record?
Is that in the dictionary?
I'm in trouble.
That'll rank up there with Representative Jewel getting us wrapped up in our underwear last year.
Well, anyway. Mr. Chair, what this, and committee members, what this does is this gives this bill an actual additional resource for the department so the department can meet the new standard of care that's required through this bill. What this language comes from, if it sounds familiar, it's the language which was in House Bill 23. Is it fair to say that? It's not out of any rules. And in House Bill 23, what we did was propose a pilot study to be looked into for intensive family preservation. And intensive family preservation services provides a standard of care and that be in place through a program that the courts can use as a new tool. It's a tool that could be actually, and because the department will mention it, it's a tool that the department actually could use now, but is not being chosen to be used. And what this would put in place is a possibility for the courts to allow families to choose as an alternative to having their children removed, going through an intensive family preservation program, which would put workers in the home working with the family and keeping the child safe. The very first consideration is the safety of the child. More than 30 states have adopted this model. This model was begun over 20 years ago, has been successfully adopted by these states and has had very successful outcomes. And I think that my aide, Nate Mohat, probably can do a better job of explaining some of the more technical adaptations to this that he has worked out with Representative Coghill's aide. Would it be all right if he explained those?
Yes.
Thank you.
Please.
Nate, would you?
I have a question. Did you mean to infer that these intensive family preservation services can't be provided if the child has been removed from the family?
They can be, yes, they can and they are in other states that have adopted them. However, they're most effective if it happens before the child is removed, but it is a reasonable alternative to be chosen afterwards. If the courts deem that, it's a court decision.
Representative Wilson.
Just a question. If I understood right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I understood right, that the reason that it's best if it's done right before the child is taken away, because it's right then is when the family is in crisis and the parent is more likely to be saying, yes, I'll do anything just to keep my kid.
That is very, very true. Certainly afterwards, sometimes that same element, and you were right, it's a crisis model. And another reason why before the child is taken away, many, many studies have shown the damage to children of absence from their parents and the breaking of building of bonds, that kind of thing. So the more damage to the child you can avoid, the better you are. But the better the child is. But yeah, you want the best situation, but thank you. Any other questions?
Please, sir, identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Nate Mohant. I'm staff to Representative Sharon Cisna. Just briefly, as you noted when you're adopting the amendment, there's a lot of pen scratches, if just in case, to clear up any questions regarding these penned-in changes to the amendment. They are because the amendment was originally written for the last version of the bill and not for the new CS, and all of these changes reflect bringing the amendment into line with the new CS. And there are a couple more changes for the exact same reason, and I'll just go through those. If you turn to page 4 of the amendments, line 12 through 15, that needs to be removed. That language is no longer necessary.
All right, so the amendment is to remove on page 4 all the material between lines 12 and 15, or from 12 to 15?
12 through 14 or 12 through 15?
Yes, 12 through 15, yes.
Is there objection? Hearing none, those are removed.
The next one is page 5. Lines 18 to 21, that also needs to be removed for the same reason as the previous.
All right, so the next amendment is to remove on page 5, lines 18, 19, 20, and 21. Objection? Okay.
And finally on page 6, lines 16 through 29.
The amendment is on page 6 of the amendment to remove all material between from line 16 through 29. Is there objection? All right. Now I'm going to ask that you all, I hope you get this saved, get us a clean copy of all this stuff before we start a business on Thursday. Can do?
Mm-hmm.
All right. And all right, and we will. Then we'll also. I'm going to give another little bite of the apple here for the folks from the Department of Law, the Attorney General's office, at least to make suggestions. So, yeah. But I would encourage you to do so and talk to the bill's kind of two sponsors now before we get to the meeting, if you can, so that we don't have any surprises here. Representative Sisman?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I did want to bring up one last point, and I don't know whether Nate had other things he wanted to mention, but one of the significant pieces here that will, we assume, will affect the department's financial view of this is the cost factor of this. The fact that in Alaska, foster care is somewhere between $8,000 to $17,000 per child per year, and in other states, the cost of intensive family preservation is somewhere between $2,000 to New York City, which is fairly expensive, is $8,000 per family per year. But that is a significant saving from our foster care system.
Yeah, I thank you. Representative Jewell?
Thank you. And when people come back on Thursday?
one of the questions that I would be interested in having answered is, when this moves forward, the availability of this kind of service throughout the state.
Yeah, I think, Teresa, were you planning on speaking to this? I mean, now. I guess I'd like you to answer a couple of questions today, if you wouldn't mind. You want to scoot over and grab a chair there? I assume that you knew that this was coming?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I was.
It's Teresa Turier from the DFYS. I don't want to put words in your mouth. It seems to me that when you and I talked about this a year ago, you basically were saying that it is the department's goal now to provide whatever services a troubled family needs in order for them to be a functioning family. And would having the, does it appear to you now, I won't hold you, that what Representative Sisna is proposing here, is this going to, what will it change in terms of your work, your department's work?
Mr. Chairman, I assume this is identical to House Bill 23. And in House Bill 23, it says that we use within existing funding, we would use those the existing funding to provide these services. This is a specific model in which caseloads go down to two per worker, and it's a 6-week service model. And so it would be important to make sure that the right families get to this service, because it may not be the right service for every family. And to the extent that it would, what it would do to existing grantees, we would have to, you know, we would have to work with them in trying to figure out how to do this model. I assume we would do this through a grant model, not state employees. So I believed we thought we would need a little bit of funding for the study, because it requires a study to be done. This was like $80,000 fiscal note. At least that was on House Bill 23. So I believe that's what it says to us, is to use existing funding, which would mean working with our existing grantees who provide family support services, family preservation services, and we have a time-limited family reunification service model. And it would provide a specific model under that grant program. And so it would impact those grantees to the extent, we don't know how, but we would work with those grantees on this model.
So does this legislation, as amended, then forces you to do a pilot? Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding.
Right. And I, am I correct in assuming that the work we have done here today with the CS and this amendment is going to alter the fiscal note?
The current fiscal note on 252, is that right, Mr. Chairman? Yes, it will alter that significantly.
In a way that'll make Mr. Coghill smile a little more. He's been real grumpy here for about 2 weeks. Is it unreasonable for us to expect a new fiscal note by Thursday?
We will, Mr. Chairman, we will have a new fiscal note for you by Thursday, before then. I'd be happy.
I'm going to look and see if Mr. If Elmer has a minority opinion on this.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the Department of Law may have a fiscal concern depending on how the conversation
holding.
All right. Is anybody else here from the department or from the administration that wants to speak to us today? I think we have online. Tony, are you still there? Is Tony Lombardo on? The Angry Gelato?
Yeah.
Thanks for your patience, Tony. I waited to hear from you and others until I had an idea what we were doing here and talking about. Go ahead and give us your testimony, Tony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm here representing today the Alaska Association of Homes for Children, as well as Covenant House Alaska. The Alaska Association of Homes for Children represents 450 licensed residential beds for the provision of services to Alaska children. Originally, we supported the original version of this bill. Significant yeoman's work has been done today, and I'd just like to make a few statements regarding what I've seen that I think are still in line with the position that the association took. First, we believe that looking to Section 1, as stated by the Department of Law, the Section 4710.005 as a construction section is read by the court like a headline to each section that follows, and that's for the entirety of Section 47. Title 47, Section 10. So we believe that what this means is that any change to Section 005 will be seen as a clear enunciation of best practices in every aspect of child in need of aid proceedings. The social workers in the association believe that as such an enunciation of best practices, that that's a positive. There is some concern, as I understand the Department of Law expressed, that it could be a little confusing for the court, but there are some guiding legal principles. The attorneys use the term in para materia, meaning that the court will have the opportunity to read the following sections of Section 10 along with the construction section of 005 and understand that that's a best practices enunciation. So we continue to support that. We think that's a good section. We have said that that could as easily be expressed in policy or regulation. It would seem to be done that way by the department, but that actually might be more work for the department than what you've done here today. So that certainly will be open to the discretion of the department to give you their opinion on that. With regard to Section 2, the repeal of AS 4710-960 may or may not produce additional changes for the state. Any time you change a liability or any potential disclaimer of liability for the state, somebody may see that as an opportunity. That's always a risk. People see the state all the time for the child, if they think that they have been wronged by a state agency. But the bottom line for us is that we champion accountability for all state agencies working with children, including the state. So any step in that direction, we think is a good step. We think that the potentiality that in the first bill for creating kind of an onerous series of regulations for the state was a problem. We didn't want to see them have to do a lot of expensive work that took time away from the kids. And so we're glad that you're dropping that. As far as we've always liked House Bill 23, and so my final comment will be that while there's a lot of work here, and I think I haven't had the ability to digest it all today, we've always liked House Bill 23. We think the family reunification services championed by Representative Sisner have always been an excellent idea. So I'll leave you with that about today. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else online or at the LIOs or offline that wants to speak to us? All right, is there anybody here in the room that wants to speak to us on this bill today? It's not my intention to take public testimony Thursday. We will let the department, the sponsor, and Department of Law have another bite of the apple on Thursday. All right. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Laurie Huguenin. I'm the director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I Sorry I didn't speak to Representative Sisna ahead of time. I didn't realize the amendment was going to be offered today, and I'm just now seeing it. So I do have a couple of comments and concerns that we would have in the implementation of family preservation services, and I think throughout the years we've discussed some of those concerns. I think it would be important to pay particular attention and have safeguards in place when you're working with families where there's also adult victims, and to think through how we define family in the family that we are trying to reunify, particularly in domestic violence situations, but also in sexual abuse of a minor situations when the offender is a parent. I think that requires some special skills and special thought, and is not something that we would want to enter into very lightly. Specifically on the amendment, on page 4, line 4, you're talking about when the department need not provide these services, and this is the fifth element. And we have unduly in front of the word threatened. And so I'd ask some consideration that maybe you think about deleting that word so that you're not qualifying threatened. That seems to indicate that there's some level of threat, that it's okay to what is that unduly threatened? So if you would give some consideration to that. Also, if you would give some consideration on page 3, line 25, what is family conflict? What does that concept entail? Are you talking about people just can't work things out together, or are you talking about domestic violence, and how is that going to be treated? And I think just in the context of family preservation services, I know in some other states it has been tried in sort of the worst case scenarios, but I think there may be some examples out there where these services are at the front. They're with neglected families, so that instead of putting your money over here where there's already so many problems, you're catching it at the start where maybe then you're not going to have these problems later down the road. And I might not be reading it correctly, but it seems like to me this is geared toward families who are really already over here in the so very many problem area, instead of maybe at the front end with neglect. So it's probably pretty late in the process to be thinking about a new model of doing that, but maybe for further dialogue you could look at trying to help those families who are still in the neglect stage instead of already have crossed over. And at this time, those are my comments, because like I said, I just had this brief time to review it.
Thank you, Lori. Uh-huh. And thank you for the work you do.
Thank you.
Representative Sisma?
Is it fair for me to make a comment in clarification?
If you want to amend your amendment, okay, go ahead. Please.
Okay, thank you very much. As a matter of fact, I fully agree with you, and one of the things that this model has been used for very successfully is, in fact, in terms of situations, for instance, in domestic violence where there's been a restraint order, and as we know, that's the most crucial time sometimes. Some of the most dangerous times is right after you have a worker in the home that can be there for long periods of time, and sometimes they literally have the worker goes and stays with the person who has made the restraint order to make sure that the family member is safe, and it has worked very well in that regard. And also, you're right. Your money should be up in front, or further upstream you can go, the better. But that's the reason we're putting this in place, or we'd like to put this in place, is this is one last chance, and it's the teachable moment, the point where the family's at the greatest crisis they could be because they're about to lose their child. And I think you're right, we need to learn, we need to work on defining family conflict. That's a good suggestion, but.
You'll work on that between now and Thursday?
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Anyone else like to testify on this bill? All right, we will take this bill up then on Thursday. And how many of you are here to speak to us about House Bill 367? Okay, I'm going to take an at ease here for a moment for people to shuffle in and shuffle out. All right, now take up House Bill 367. That is Medical Assistance Program. Reneva.
Up. You want to, John?
Let me kick it off, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 367 takes the discussion up with the Denali Kid Care rate. Right now we're at 200% of poverty, and this would suggest we bring it down to 150% of poverty. There are some housekeeping measures in the bill that just do some language changes that, for example, like with child care on page 2, line 3, we just take the hyphen out. So the drafter took the opportunity to do some house cleaning issues. But the real issue is on page 4, line 9, page 4, line 5 as well, which really moves the number from 200% of the federal poverty guideline to 150% of the poverty line, which is a federal guideline, by the way. And I asked my staff from Eva to come here and help me go through some of the numbers, trying to figure out, you know, how much does that really equate to when you're talking, say, about a family of 3 or 4 or 5 when it comes to child health care. First, I just one more time, I got to say this into the committee. I did this, 2 years ago? I started at the 100% level. I barely got out of here alive. And it was just asking the question, was that expansion really what we wanted to do? And the resounding answer was yes, it is something that they wanted to do. And it was under the Smart Start program that passed some years ago. But once again, I'm here asking us the question, is this really the direction we want to go? There's two sides to it. There's the dollar side and there's a policy side. To me, the policy side of an expanding subsidy level for health care is something that I'm not willing to go for. There's a dollar side that right now, under the fiscal condition we're in, can we really afford to go down this road further? But what I'm not saying, and I want everybody to hear this real clear, is I am not saying there's not a need out there. The need for child health care is there just as sure as we're sitting here. So I understand that there are going to be some people who are going to say, we can't afford to do that anymore. But I think that has to be part of the legitimate discussion of what are we going to do to fill the $800 million hole in Alaska. So it does affect policy in that regard. I do not expect this to fill the $800 million hole. And as we get to looking at the numbers, you'll see that it's way less than that. The argument that the investment into children's health care is going to be cheaper at this end than at the other end, I agree with. I think that that's an important part of the discussion. I also think that there are people at that level, between 150 and 200% level, that can afford it. And I'm saying, before I'm willing to take money out of somebody else's pocket to pay for this, I'm willing to say, you got to be a part of that discussion too. And I'm going to ask Reneva to help me with at what level it now is, say, for a family of three, at what income level, and what are the exceptions to counting on that income, and then what would it be when we, if we go down to the 150% level. So there's a chart in your packet that I'd like to draw your attention to, and it's, let's see, how many of these are flagged, Reneva?
For the record, Reneva Moss, Legislative Aid for Representative Coghill. Jason is copying the new charts for the other committee members now.
I think that's the best place to start, Mr. Chairman.
Before he gives you those, what I would like to explain is that Alaska is 125% of the federal poverty level. So the figures...
I don't understand what that means.
That means that the federal level for a family of four is $1,472.
Per?
That is an income, a monthly income.
Okay.
The federal government sets Alaska standards 25% higher, so Alaska's poverty level is $1,840.
For an individual, Mr. Chairman.
So when we talk about Alaska's poverty level, it is already 125% of the federal poverty level. So, and while we're waiting for the charts, I wanted to explain to you the exemptions to the income, things that aren't counted in your income when they figure what your income is. The permanent fund dividends are not counted as income. Native corporation dividends up to $200 per recipient is not counted as income. Household inhabitants who are not biological or adoptive parents, their income is not considered. The income of a step-parent, regardless of what it is, it could be $100,000. If that income is added to the household income and would disqualify the child, that income is exempted. It is not counted. Under the 200% of Alaska poverty level, which is 125%, a family of four can have an annual income of $44,160. When you add in their dividend, that's $51,561.
And they would qualify for... Last year's dividend.
Yes. Under a monthly figure... Not including the dividend, a family of four under the 200% level makes $3,680. The 150% level that HB 367 would change this to, a family of four would have a monthly income of $2,760. The annual income, including the, excuse me, I did not include the dividend. The annual income would be $33,120. So if you had a family of four, you would add approximately $5,400 to that, so you're almost up to the $40,000 mark.
Representative Wilson.
I'm just trying to think. That would cover a lot, even of teachers that just counting one parent. I mean, that, you know, a lot of teachers make less than that, I guess is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And they have insurance from this, because they're teachers, right?
Through the chair, I would like to clarify that the Denali Kid Care Program is not for people who already have insurance through their employer. That would disqualify them.
Representative Wilson, continue.
I would like to make a comment here because this is something that was brought to my attention this past year. I had a parent come to me. This parent was very upset because this parent had insurance. And the provider that this parent was going to with her children told her to drop her insurance because it would be real easy for her to assign on to Denali Kid Care, because it would be easier for them, be much less paperwork, and would just be much easier. Now, this provider was not a private provider. This was a provider that would get state funds. I'm just not going to go any further than that. But more than one parent told me this. So what is happening is we're picking up, I don't know how prevalent this is, I do not know that, but this parent was really aggravated about this. I don't know how often that happens, but it does happen. And that is not good all the way around.
Representative Coghill, through the chair, did you want me to discuss what I discussed with the department today?
I think...
And allow them a chance to answer.
Mr. Chairman, we did find some discrepancy in some of the numbers as we added them up, and we did ask them if they would come and help us look at the monthly cost and some of the areas we found where they didn't add up the way I thought they should. So, with your indulgence. Bringing the policy discussion up, Mr. Chairman, I am content to let the people testifying, because it really is a policy call, no matter what the numbers shake out at.
Yeah, and we've got a lot of people out there, and I appreciate their patience. I would like to hear briefly from the department. Is that you, Mr. Levy? Levy.
Mr. Chairman?
I'm sorry, Representative Jewell.
Just a process question. I have to leave in 10 minutes. Are you planning on moving the bill out today?
I do not believe we will hear all the testimony, get it done today.
No?
That's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Jay Leiby, Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. And I do want to speak today in opposition to the bill. as noted, if this bill were to be enacted, approximately 3,800 children and approximately 722 pregnant women would lose coverage. The sponsor suggested this bill would reduce eligibility from 200% of poverty to 150%. The first point I'd like to make about the bill relates to the fiscal note. The proposed reduction would save about $5 million in general funds, but it also means that as a state we would lose approximately $12 million in federal funds, because the way Denali Kid Care works, for every dollar we spend, about 70 cents, 71 cents comes from the federal government. So aside from providing the health care that kids need and pregnant women need, we're also leveraging federal funds into our health care system. I also want to talk about some of these savings. There are savings that are attributed to kids who lose their coverage, but these savings, or at least a portion of these savings, will be projected or will be shifted to other payers, because all these kids that lose coverage, I wouldn't sit here and say that all these kids that lose coverage are going to lose health care. They will go somewhere in the system and be cared, most likely in an emergency room or something. When they're served in an emergency room and nobody pays that bill, that's the bill that is going to be that the state in general is going to pay. Other payers in the system will pay some of that bill. And when that happens, that bill will not be paid at probably at a 70-30 federal share rate. It will be most likely be more of a rate that's paid by more general or more state, at least Alaska, funds. I also want to address Representative Wilson's issue about people being told to sign up for Denali Kid Care, and then because they could get coverage that way. in fact, there's a 12-month waiting period, and so if you go in to apply for the program and you're asked if you currently have insurance, if you currently have insurance, then you are not eligible to sign up for the program. And so even so that family may have been told that they could drop their current coverage and sign up with Denali Kid Care, they would not have been able to get insurance through that methodology. They would have had, there would be a waiting period. And so they would have to go, the kids would have to go without coverage for a period of time.
Representative Wilson.
I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How do you please that? How do you if someone comes in and says, no, I don't have insurance because they dropped it yesterday, how do you know that?
We go in and do quality checks on applications. I'd ask, Bob, can you help me on that if we?
For the record, Bob Labby, Director of the Division of Medical Assistance. We have actually through public assistance, quality control reviewers have looked at that issue and have found that it's really not occurring to the extent that we think it might be based on the anecdotes. There have been some folks that have dropped insurance and have applied, and there have been a few cases that have been, there have been good cause for that, but for the most part, it's not occurring to that extent. We have advised, I know in the case of Representative Wilson has raised, we have advised the grantees not to advise people like that, because I think some of them were not aware of the disqualification, so you could actually leave a person hanging out there, drop their insurance, go over to pick it up through the state and be told, I'm sorry, you're not eligible, and you know, that's not a good outcome. Can't say there aren't some instances where things happen or get by, but we've done a quality review on that, and it was not going on to any extent. I could get the report. I don't have the exact numbers. I could get that for you if you'd like to look at it.
I need some help here. Representative Wilson said, how do you police this? And I don't know that you answered the question.
Well, I think what we do is if we do a spot check on the people who've applied and been approved, and go back and see what the circumstances were. That much more intensive review.
I want you to watch carefully and see if Mr. Coring and Mr. Coghill and I's blood pressure go up. Can you go in and find out whether an individual invade their personal records and find out if they have insurance somewhere else?
I'm not sure that we can the way you're saying it.
I hope you can't.
We do have, though, if a person has applied, we do have access to information that comes through both from them and from the providers that submit claims, as well as from other data match sources.
So somebody's...
Once they're on, but most of this is when you go and actually sit down with the people and find out, like, where do they work? Does that employer have coverage? That's how you go back and check on that. The application process is fairly simple, but the quality control review process is a much more detailed review. I mean, that's basically...
My question is, do you have access to people's records of whether or not they have entered into a private relationship with an insurance carrier?
Not generally. We have access, like, to their employer to find out if the employer has coverage or provides coverage. That's generally where this comes up, is employer-based coverage.
How's your blood pressure? All right, thank you. I'm sorry. I don't want to divert us here.
One other question on the 12-month issue.
Yeah, Representative Coghill.
Just what does it take to waive the 12-month requirement?
We've applied kind of a formula that looks at what the household circumstances are. We've had... I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but we've had some requests, and the numbers that have been approved have been, you know, half a dozen. And it's been basically that there's some reason why that's occurred, and you look at their income and other family circumstances and say, well, given the situation, we will allow it. And it's handled in my office here. I mean, it's all handled by essentially one spot. It's not spread around, so... They do kind of a look at that, and we've said no to probably 95% of the requests that have come up, approved maybe 5%. Large number that have even come in, but
I want to get to some of the public testimony. But I have a, as I understood Representative Coghill's representations, our rate, the qualifying threshold, is actually 250%. Of the federal level, or 200% of the state level as adjusted for cost of living. How do you see that, sir?
It's the latter, Mr. Chairman. It's 200% of the Alaska income level, which is the federal poverty level adjusted 25% to account for Alaska's cost of living.
Okay, so it is close to 250% of the federal federal level down in the South 48.
I don't think that's the math, but I'd have to think about it for a minute.
Okay. Both of us can think about it. All right. So what process did the department go through to decide that the 2X multiplier was the right threshold to set for Alaskans?
Mr. Chairman, we thought about what we wanted to do when the federal CHIP proposal was first made. And, of course, we had several choices to make. The first choice was whether or not to have a Medicaid program or have a standalone program. And we chose to have a Medicaid program for a couple of reasons. First of all, because if you have a standalone program, the federal law says that you have to cover individuals who are also Indian Health Service eligible. And if we cover individuals who are Indian Health Service eligible through Medicaid, we get 100% of the cost of providing that care reimbursed from the federal government. If we were to do a standalone program, then Alaska's cost of providing that care to Alaska Natives would not be reimbursed 100% by the federal government. And so we have Alaska has the highest percentage of Alaska Natives, Indian Health Service beneficiaries, any place in the country. And so for that reason alone, it made a lot of sense to go in this direction.
Sure.
When we looked at the income threshold, we actually had a similar policy discussion to what Representative Coghill is suggesting. And that's the question of at what point should the state stop subsidizing health care and should a private citizen be eligible for their own coverage? And we chose a 200% level because it seemed to us that that was a level of income at which individuals and families had trouble purchasing insurance on their own, that the insurance market out there wasn't sufficiently developed, particularly for going out and just buying a policy for your child. That those policies, first of all, were easy to get, and secondly, that they would have been affordable. And we actually had a meeting before we went into this with insurance executives from several of the five or six of the seven largest insurance companies around the state, and had this discussion with them. And what they told us was that this low-income insurance market is not necessarily a market that is one of their prime focus. Because it's very expensive for them to manage this market. People come in and out of it. The administrative costs are high. People change jobs a lot, and so might move in and out of an insurance policy. And so it seemed to us that 200% was a reasonable cutoff in terms of what a family could afford.
Okay.
Or what was available to them out in the market.
Is Mr. Coghill and his staff, Are they in the ballpark when they say that now the family of four, the qualifications is around 44,000 plus whatever they get a dividend?
Correct.
Okay, and it would be reduced down to 33,000 and change plus the dividend, maybe around 38,000?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I haven't done the math myself, but I presume that's correct. I presume
right.
That's correct.
All right. What I'd like, do you want a question?
No, pardon me. I was just waiting.
Representative Wilson.
I do have a question. How much carryover is there? I know, like, if a woman's pregnant and she goes to the doctor and they find out that she's pregnant and right away they wanted her to sign up with WIC because then it's retroactive for before she got pregnant. How much of that would be already covered from the WIC program? Is there an overlap? I don't know.
I think that through the chair, Representative, it's two different services. You know, WIC allows you to sign up for is nutritional kinds of services. The Medicaid would be more medically oriented.
Okay.
And so the services wouldn't necessarily overlap.
And one last question. I'm sorry, are you going to continue?
Yeah, I just wanted to, because they do get whatever whatever, when they file for that, they also are signing up for something where there is it down Denali Kid Care then that they're getting? What pays their doctor bills and stuff? Because I know that does happen, but I don't know what process it is.
I would assume it would have to be the Medicaid program, because I don't believe WIC pays for any kind of medical services.
Okay, and now are you...
Yeah, well, that's not my area, but we can check on that.
Okay, go ahead.
But there are linkages. If people apply for WIC, they can pick up applications for Denali Kid Care at those offices.
I mean, that's what my question is, because if... I would like to know what program that kicks in or whatever papers they fill out, because I've been to more than one clinic that does that, and that makes sure that the clinic or the doctor gets paid for maternity care throughout that pregnancy. And I just want to know if we're saying that there's 722 pregnant women that wouldn't get taken care of when indeed they would qualify under a different program, I'd like to know what that is.
I see. Okay, I understand the question now. I think you'll find there's not an overlap for prenatal care, but we'll check for sure.
I'm wanting to make sure we get a chance today to hear from the people who won't be able to come back on Thursday, and I appreciate all your patience. Representative Stevens?
Well, I'll try to make this very short, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question of you concerning, I'm a little concerned about the salary levels, because salary levels, it's a game you can play. I heard Representative Wilson mention a teacher. Well, certainly there are many teachers that don't make $44,000 in a salary. When you add in their benefits, they certainly do make much more than $44,000. So I guess my real question to you is, are you seeing a lot of professional people making use of this? Are you seeing a lot of fully employed people making use of this program?
Through the chair. Yeah, I think we do see. I think a lot of the families, particularly in the level of income above between 150 and 200%, I think there are a lot of working families in that population. Again, they're generally families who do not have an option, do not have the ability to, who are not purchasing health care through their employer.
But you're not seeing families who are employed and have the benefit of insurance through, specifically the question of teachers. Are there a lot of teachers in your program?
Through the chair,
I don't know. We would know. I think most of the folks are like self-employed that you run into in those ranges. There are people that might qualify on the income level, but they're typically insured. Oh, sorry. There are a lot of people that might qualify in those ranges, but they're typically have like coverage through the districts or through the state or whatever. The ones I've heard about are mostly self-employed people, and that I've talked to individuals that are like in the building trades that are, framing and roofing and that kind of thing. Ones I've talked about in the mat suit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Coghill? For the testimony, I will. Okay. All right. Here's what I want to do. I'm going to... First of all, is there anybody here in the room today that wouldn't be able to, that came specially for this purpose and are out of town, wouldn't be able to testify on Thursday? All right, I'm going to take one lap around all the LIOs, and for the people at the different legislative information offices, if you would, amongst yourselves, if there are people there who... It would be very inconvenient to come back. I'd appreciate you offering them the courtesy of speaking first. And we're going to start first at Anchorage, and then we'll go around the state, and we'll go at least one time around. Please try to limit your testimony to 2 minutes, and I'll give you a warning 20 or 30 seconds out. And if somebody ahead of you is, then we'll come back and try to make another lap today. So in Anchorage... who would like to speak first?
Kathleen Fitzgerald is here.
Go ahead, Kathleen. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Kathleen Fitzgerald. I reside at 4521 South Park Bluff Drive in Anchorage. And I'm here speaking on behalf of the Alaska Sea Coalition. Denali Kid Care is a very important piece of health care for Alaska families. In particular, the coalition believes that Denali KidCare promotes the best outcomes for children. When they're healthy, they can learn. Pregnant women who receive prenatal care are less likely to deliver children who have health care issues or have disabilities. We believe that the increased cost, additionally, from the perspective of someone with developmental disabilities or disabilities, that families who fit in this 200% range and have children with disabilities, it's extremely difficult for them because of the increased cost and just providing the support that you need and the cost that you generally have associated with raising a child with a disability. So in addition, from a disability standpoint, we would promote the 200 level percentage. And we also think that it's just good business to provide that coverage, even though it costs us $5 million in Medicaid dollars. What it saves us in the federal dollars and provides for the medical community and for healthy families is really important to us. So I just wanted to say in closure, because I know we have a lot of people that want to talk on this issue, that the Key Coalition is strongly opposed to reducing the income level on Denali KidCare. And I just have briefly a letter from a mom who is working and not able to come. She's one of those working parents. And it'll just take me a second. So taking my Key Coalition hat off and wearing the hat of a person who works in the office next door. This is from Jerry Heiner, 7300 Glade Place here in Anchorage. And she says, I am a single parent with four children, three still at home. I work full-time and attend the University of Alaska half-time in order to secure a future for my children and myself. Even with full-time employment, I still struggle financially and need some temporary support until I have completed my education. Denali KidCare has been a wonderful benefit for our family. I no longer have to decide if they can make it until Monday because I can't afford to take them to the doctor, gambling on their health over money. It has made access to medical treatment more available by reducing the financial burden that is often expected at the time of treatment. My children no longer have to ask, can we afford glasses or medicine? Denali KidCare has decreased the stress level in our home by affording access to needed medical care for my children. I think that says a lot for what I want to say, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the time to present the Key Coalition's position.
Yeah, thank you. And any and all of you can, at our LIO, they can send your written testimony into us. And we'll make sure that it gets distributed. We're going to go now to Sitka. Who would like to speak for us from the Sitka LIO?
Good afternoon. Years ago that we sort of had three classes of patients in terms of finances. Those who were poor and would be covered by Medicaid, those who had considerable money or insurance and were going to be able to afford self-care, and the great middle class of people who frequently were the fishermen, people who were in small businesses, various small entrepreneurs who did not have any real access to insurance and had to do things on a sort of a self-pay basis. And those are the people that frequently got sort of left behind as far as medical care was concerned. They frequently would hold off until the end, come in when things were bad. They sort of skimped on things like prenatal care. They skimped on child care. And the price to them in terms of what it eventually cost them to secure care for themselves. house was frequently fairly high and frequently paid eventually by the state. And I think that if indeed you really seriously talk about dropping these people out of coverage, what's going to happen is that the state's going to wind up paying considerably more for it further down the line. I am also on the school board around here. One of the things that we see that is that problems that aren't dealt with early in life frequently become problems in the school system.
Can you summarize, Doc?
Okay. And so, at this point, I think that we need to continue the program as it is. It's covering something that needs to be covered.
Thank you. I just remind everybody there's no talk.